This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can always call us to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio, WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Danny Haar. He's editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Hello there, Danny.
Good morning.
And Daniela Altomare, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Hello there, Daniela.
Hi.
So we're going to start with some news from the state capitol. Ned Lamont, the governor-elect, has been assembling his team. We've talked a little bit about the transition so far, but he made a few really key announcements, both of them maybe not huge surprises. He tapped Bridgewater Associates hedge fund executive and former Chris Dodd aide Ryan Drazewicz to be his chief of staff. And here's Max Reese from NBC Connecticut asking Drazewicz about how Lamont is plucking someone from the private sector and from a big hedge fund like Bridgewater to be his top man.
Do you think that your role will also be a kind of an olive branch to the private sector and the hedge fund world, some of the biggest employers in the state?
I think it's an olive branch to everyone. And I think today is a new chapter, a new way of doing things. Governor-elect and I have talked extensively about this with respect to having an open door and a new way of doing things. And so as we move around the state having those conversations, we're letting everyone know that all ideas are welcome from all areas of our economy.
From all areas of the economy, Colin, and I suppose that a hedge fund executive would look at the state as a type of economy. But I'm wondering what you think about this particular choice as Ned Lamont goes into Hartford and needs to not only extend olive branches outside to business, but also needs to get some work done within the state capitol.
Oh, first of all, can I say olive branch? We gave them $22 million. They can go buy an olive grove with the taxpayer money that we have given to the world's largest hedge fund. Bridgewater's worth, what, like $150
billion?
62. So, 162. I'm my numbers are out of date. So, I mean, you know, I'm offended, I guess, by the notion that they need any olive branches. They're doing just fine. They're a $162 billion hedge fund. We, the poor citizens of Connecticut, gave them $22 million as part of our corporate welfare strategy here. But I don't know this guy. And so I don't want to, I said this last week too. I mean, he might be terrific. I don't know. On the surface of it, it looks like a bad idea. I realize that, yes, you need to have a pipeline to the business community, you know, that we've got all these concerns, which we're going to be talking about probably all day here in one form or another. But, you know, this is also a job where you really got to know the building, you know, and Ned doesn't. Ned is not part of the culture there. I mean, Daniela probably has a better sense than any of us here how finely grained that culture is and how much you really need people around you who know how to get things done, who know who the long-term players are and what, you know, Lynn Fasano likes in his coffee. Or I'm, you know, not that that's the chief of staff job, but you know what I'm saying here anyway, that ultimately a lot of Ned's early work is going to be sort of figuring out the lay of the land, and he's got a chief of staff who doesn't know the lay of the land. I really think he should have – he needs another person. I don't know what that person's job is going to be, but that person is going to be the person who actually knows how the building works.
Talk about that, Danielle. I mean, the job of chief of staff and knowing the building, knowing the players that are there.
Yeah, it is incredibly important. And, you know, we've seen over the past 8 years or so with Governor Malloy, there's been not always a close relationship with the legislature, between the administration and the legislature. You know, Malloy was also in some ways an outsider, not from the business world, but from you know, municipality. He didn't have a lot of friends in the legislature. And, you know, some would say he really never did. He still doesn't. And also, when you look at the legislature, I mean, look at what happened over the past election cycle when, you know, we've seen a big rise in the number of progressives getting elected this time. So how are they going to work with this guy? I mean, you know, it's going to be an interesting dynamic. You have, you know, a newly ascendant, Democratic caucus, especially the liberals within the caucus who are talking about, you know, raising taxes on the rich and a whole host of other progressive ideas. And, you know, we'll see how those play out with this guy.
Well, exactly. Danny?
Well, this is a little bit of the rise of a technocracy here. And I think you can overstate or understate the degree to which a governor needs to be in touch with the rest of the people in the building, as they call it. The problem with Governor Malloy in respect to the legislature was not his knowledge. You know, you can meet people in 15 minutes. It was his willingness and ability to sit down with people and hammer things out. Ned Lamont is a different type of governor that way, and that's more of a technocracy type thing than it is a policy type thing. And so I don't see a problem with who he's putting in office, especially since there are going to be people like George Jepson around who is key behind the scenes now and will continue to be.
Well, do we know that for a fact, that George Jepson is going to be key behind? I think George Jepson is going to become a college president or something.
UConn.
So, you know, I would just say that Malloy's first chief of staff was Tim Bannon. Tim Bannon is a guy supremely connected to everybody in the building. Also, everybody liked Tim Bannon. I think that was a very smart play. They knew that Malloy was going to be a porcupine, and so they put a guy in there whom everybody liked. Now, he didn't stay there really long enough probably to help Malloy as much as he needed. But Bannon, compared to this guy, Bannon would really know, you know, all the sort of channels of power and stuff like that. And yeah, you're right. We could over-fetishize that, I suppose. But it's not a nothing consideration anyway.
I want to turn to the other key job that Ned Lamont announced yesterday for Secretary of the Office of Policy Management. Lamont has elected the City of Hartford's Budget Director, Melissa McCaw, in a new gig. She'll be the person out front of the Lamont administration confronting big budget deficits that we'll be talking about in just a minute. She's played a key role in securing a state bailout of Hartford city finances. Here she is talking about the bailout and why she's the right person to lead Connecticut out of its fiscal crisis.
What I think is most important about that experience is that Hartford is now on a strong path. I was a part of that team in achieving that outcome. And I think that it's important to have had the tough experience and not just the rosy experience, and to bring a Secretary of OPM in that can not only have almost two decades of experience in budget and finance, but also bring some municipal perspective, I think is of value.
So, Danielle, I'm wondering, on one hand, there's a chief of staff who comes from a hedge fund, as you say, newly ascendant progressives, probably not all that thrilled about either the corporate welfare we've extended to hedge funds or hedge funds in particular as an avatar for what Connecticut is supposed to be, and someone who maybe doesn't know the building inside so well. On the other hand, there's a whole bunch of people at the state capitol that aren't all that terribly thrilled about the role of state government in bailing out a city like Hartford. And here the new OPM secretary comes with that very specific experience as the thing she's talking up.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of reception she gets. I think, you know, also you can't discount the fact, you know, she's a woman. She's an African-American woman. That's significant as we talk about, you know, sort of looking at who Ned Lamont picks, who he surrounds himself with, what kind of voices, what kind of people he picks to, you know, help him run the state. I think that's something that shouldn't get lost.
Yeah, and I think the other thing too, Danny, is he made a promise that he's going to bring together business and government, and here to his two top people, you know, somebody strictly from business, somebody really from government.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, we sort of think of Ned Lamont as an outsider to government. He's very, very sophisticated player, and he understands how the game is played. And with these two picks, you can see that he understands how the game is played. He's sending a message that the cities are not going to be, not only not going to be forgotten, but they're going to get every bit as much support as they got under the current governor. And again, to repeat what I said before, I think it's a bit of a technocracy play. This is not this is a person who's really steeped in numbers. You know, and who knows how the numbers work. She spent 8 years, you know, with a green visor on and, you know, over on Capitol Avenue moving numbers around. So I think it's really about that.
Ben Barnes, who is Dan Malloy's OPM secretary, he knows a lot about numbers too, right? I mean, he didn't necessarily have the easiest go of it in either his ability to help Governor Malloy get the budget problems under control, or more importantly, perhaps, his ability to communicate that, you know, as we heard, the state of permanent fiscal crisis moniker didn't exactly help that administration work to get out of the hole that it was in.
Ben is a great numbers guy, but he's really big into economics, macroeconomic policy, and he was, of course, Malloy's policy guy in Stanford. And so I think he was coming in broader. What Melissa McCaw ends up being, we never know. We don't know yet because people broaden. She's obviously extremely bright, and I don't doubt her ability to be broad into policy, but that's not where she's coming from yet.
Colin?
Yeah, I think I don't know Melissa McCaw, and I think it's early to make a guess about how she's going to do in this job. I mean, these two jobs are, in most administrations, the two most important jobs, chief of staff, head of OPM. Often governors use the person in this job as kind of a communicator about fiscal issues. Often this person will put out numbers that the state comptroller doesn't agree with. So there's a lot of time spent on our part trying to kind of decode what's going on. You know, the OPM says there's a surplus and the comptroller says, well, no, there isn't, or that the deficit's worse. So one of her jobs probably, unless Lamont sets up his shop a little bit differently, is communicating to the state of Connecticut about what the governor's office actually thinks is going on with the state budget and with both revenue and spending. But and that's maybe a little bit outside what she's done so far in the past. You know, as Dan says, she's been 8 years city of Hartford, 8 years at OPM, and then 3 years city of Hartford. But I don't think it was that kind of like go in front of the cameras and microphone kind of job. And typically that is a part of this job.
I'm going to sort of put a pin in this discussion about what Lamont and his new team has to face as far as that budget deficit and just take a little sidetrack. Danny, you said that this may signal that Ned Lamont is going to be as good to the cities as Dan Malloy has been. We read in our friend Kevin Rennie's blog today that the capital city may have a very interesting fight coming up as Eddie Perez, the former mayor of the city of Hartford, is likely now to challenge Luke Bronin, who himself was looking to ascend to the governor's job not too terribly long ago, for, you know, the mayor's job in the city of Hartford. I don't know that we're terribly surprised about this. What do you see in this sort of interesting little development of Eddie Perez getting back in the game?
Well, there are a lot of angles to it. First of all, I think he's going to fall short because his transgressions weren't big enough. He needs to go to Ganem School and learn that if you want to come back, you got to come back from something really big, right? You can't have a sort of a half-assed, you know, non-conviction where you're suing the city. You know, not only is he not, you know, recalcitrant, he's suing the city for his money back because even though he pleaded guilty to the precise charges that he was let off on because they did the case wrong, he wants the $800,000.
The case wrong.
Right. Yeah. So it's to me, it's not a big enough transgression for him to come back, but it's too big a transgression for him to run. But really,
if he takes down a Dunkin' Donuts now, I'm going to blame you. Yeah. I'm going to say you're the Twinkie defense here.
Exactly.
Danny Hart made me do it.
He does have Hubie Santos, though. So I think it's certainly you can't overlook the fact that Lamont's choice of Melissa McCaw is more than an olive branch. It's an embrace of Luke Bronin. And we see that Luke Bronin's tie to the state capitol is going to continue, and the degree to which that helped him get in office is going to help him stay in office.
What do you see in this news, Daniela? Eddie Perez coming back, Luke Bronin getting a hug from Ned Lamont and maybe having ties to the state capitol. It may or may not be a good thing as far as the Hartford electorate.
Who knows? It's certainly going to be interesting, though. It's going to make the next year, the municipal election cycle, very interesting in Hartford.
It really will. Colin, a thought?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I like Luke Bronin as a person. I think he's got some political problems. The biggest political problem started when he announced he was going to run for governor, having said beforehand that that was not the kind of thing that he was going to do, that he was going to serve out his term. That was really regarded as a breach of faith. There are other simmering issues in the city having to do with education. All of that stuff is going to come to the fore. My sense, I don't know, as I've been sort of like, if I'm standing around anybody from Hartford, I've been asking them this question. The idea that Eddie was going to get in is a very badly kept secret. Everybody knows that that's a possibility right now. I don't think it's the only possibility. And one thing that we should watch for, like Luke Bronin did a really good job of courting the support of the north end of Hartford, the African-American section and Jamaican-American section of Hartford. My sense is that he's lost some of that support. And the question is, could Eddie move in and sew that support up and make that part of his base? Or is there going to be somebody who's going to emerge out of that community? I wouldn't rule out the possibility of more than one person getting into the race besides just Luke. So if you have kind of a three-way race, something like that, then it gets really dynamic.
Did you have a thought, Danny?
Yeah, just dozens of layoffs and a whole bunch of cutbacks in the budget, and having to spend most of your administration on a central budget crisis does not do wonders for your outreach to the neighborhoods, which is where voters are.
Okay, central budget crisis. That allows us to get back to the initial thought here. So as Ned Lamont takes office, he's facing about a $1.7 billion deficit for the fiscal year that starts upcoming. He doesn't want to raise the state income tax. He doesn't want to tap into the rainy day fund. Where exactly is this money going to come from? Colin, we'll just go around here and try to see what this new team has as possibilities to solve this big budget crisis.
Well, do we want to talk about the Doomsday Commission here, or just sort of just in general?
Explain again who the Doomsday Commission, as you title them, are, because
Danny's,
they're back in the news.
No, Meltdown.
Meltdown Commission?
Meltdown Commission.
I'm sorry. Meltdown.
He calls them the Meltdown Commission. You call them the Doomsday Commission. This is this nonpartisan panel that was put together and gave a whole bunch of recommendations during the last legislative session, which were roundly ignored by the legislature and the governor at the time. And they're back with sort of a 2.0. It's like a reboot of this series.
They have a new drummer.
Oh, a new drummer.
Yeah, so it's
they go through drummers very
sound
quickly.
Sound is different, yeah. So this is like a whole bunch of people that Danny gets man crushes on, like Jim Smith, who was the head of Webster Bank, and Bob Petroselli, and all these
guys,
people.
Yeah.
So, and what are they really called? Sustainability and Accountability?
Commission on Fiscal Sustainability and Economic Growth.
Oh, okay. So
it's like ELP. It's
yeah, right.
They have a very good
yes.
And I mean,
acronym.
I don't know. I like to make fun of them.
Don't forget Cindy Bigelow, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, and Greg Butler, and who's a great friend of mine, and and Roxanne and Cody. They're really smart people on this commission. But I mean, I think they're looking at the same intractable problems that everybody else does. So they've come back and restated one of their premises, which I'm getting really tired of, which is cut $1 billion out of state government, which is also, by the way, Bob Stefanowski's principle. Well, just cut $1 billion out of state government. Well, you know, you can't just say that. You know, I think you should be legally required to show us the first $100 million of your cuts. You can't just say, oh, well, we can cut $1 billion. So, I mean, just to go back to your original question, let's put the Doomsday Commission aside for just a second. Look, there's only three knobs on the stove. One of them is the stuff that you do with state employees and, you know, existing contracts and benefits and stuff like that. Another knob is what you can actually cut out of programs and personnel. And believe me, this is a pretty lean workforce at this point. It wasn't like Malloy didn't do stuff like that. I mean, he did both of those things. And the third knob is revenue. I mean, they're really, you know, now within revenue, there's maybe a couple of sub-chapters, including how you can restructure taxes as the Doomsday Commission proposes. You can try to make changes in the tax code that are revenue neutral and stuff like that. But there's only three knobs on the stove, and you probably have to turn all of them at some point. The question is, what kind of mix do you go for?
There are three knobs on the stove, but there's also a safety valve, and that's financial engineering. Mm. And every year, the state comes up with about $400 to $500 million, sometimes more, sometimes less, in various. And Ben Barnes is a genius at this. I hope Melissa McCaw can do it. Something that engineers $400 or $500 million without either raising taxes or cutting spending. And the hospital trick was it the last time, and that was $500 million roughly by paying the hospitals more in. By taxing the hospitals and then giving it back to them and calling that Medicaid and getting reimbursement from the federal government.
Are you suggesting that fiscal tricks such as that
are
a prudent way to solve an intractable budget deficit problem that is not only for this upcoming fiscal year but the following one as well?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. Financial trickery is part.
He's right, actually.
What everybody is saying, and I've talked to a number of the people we've been talking about this, and they have to continue the hospital tax gimmick. And it is a gimmick, and other states do it. The Connecticut pushed it ahead by pushing it from 6% to 8% of hospital revenues. And so it has to happen. And something like that or that will happen. My calculation is we're still left, even with the higher revenues that we got in the simply higher tax collections, we're left with about a $300 million gap that has to be filled. And someone that we've been talking about a lot this morning mentioned to me yesterday that, you know, don't forget this legislature, and Daniela mentioned this about the liberals, they're going to be pushing for about $300 million in extra spending, regardless of reality.
Yeah. And go ahead.
Well, I just was thinking when, you know, Colin was talking about the knobs, there's a fourth knob that Lamont has talked about, I think, repeatedly throughout the campaign, and that's growth, right? So isn't he predicting 3% growth?
Sure.
Now, you know.
But that's not a knob you can turn. You just have to hope, though. You have to hope it happens.
Yeah, but, I mean, he would say, and I don't know if people would agree with this or not, but he would say that, you know, he's going to bring in new businesses. He brought in Infosys, which, you know, they'll be having their big unveiling today. I mean, there's, you know.
Recession! Excuse me, sorry.
I think he just cough said recession, but please continue.
Well, I think that's been his answer when you ask about that. So people can react to that cynically if they want, but that's something that he said.
That's something he said. It's something that a lot of people have said will be the salvation, Colin. I mean, we're going to get to maybe Danny's recession idea right after the break, but did you have a last thought?
No, I mean, you know, just to go back to the Doomsday Commission for a second, some of the early recommendations were really kind of interesting. The problem that they have right now, I mean, they got the spotlight back again. But, I mean, it's hard to look at their proposals and not see it as kind of a payday for rich people. I mean, rich people do really well under the system. It's a real expansion of sales tax. Most of the tax relief, the income tax relief, comes to upper-income people, which is called Sal Luciano, one of Danny's friends in the state unions, to call it the Yacht Club Commission.
They did propose also the $15 minimum wage, right?
Right.
Commission on Let Them Eat Cake. It is almost exactly the same tax increase from groceries alone, $148 million, as it would be by cutting the highest-end tax on the income from 6.99 to 6.7. They line up amazingly parallel.
Right, but there's like $350 million of high-end tax relief.
Well, that's right. There's some really complicated stuff in there that we don't I don't understand myself. You may. $200 million of it is stuff that they try to explain, and it's like, okay.
What we're going to do is we're going to come back after a break, and we're going to talk about what Danny was sort of alluding to is, are there some signs in our economy that maybe that upcoming growth that Ned Lamont is so hoping for is not only not coming, but maybe there's a recession coming, not just to Connecticut, but to this entire country. Dan Haar is here from Hearst Connecticut Media. Daniela Altamari is here from the Hartford Current. Colin McEnroe from WNPR in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse or call us at 860-275-7266. We'll get to a call in just a moment. But I do want to tell you that we're talking today with Daniela Altamari, who's the State House reporter for the Hartford Current, and Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, and our own Colin McEnroe. Colin, what's in your show today?
Well, just a quick bit of context. So in the legends of our show, the mythology of our show, the worst show we ever did was a show about toast. And Mike Pesca compares it to The Day the Clowns Cried, the Jerry Lewis movie that was like such a disaster. So he says that's the Toast Show is our version of that. So we've sort of thought about that. We've decided that we're going to sort of face this. And so this week, today we're doing a show about toothbrushes, and tomorrow we're doing a show about towels. We're trying to lift the curse of the toast. And we should say that John Dankosky appears on one of those two shows.
Yeah, so we won't tell you which one. And, of course, this will make for quite a transition, because coming up today at 11 o'clock, we will have live coverage from NPR of the funeral of George H.W. Bush, coverage from NPR starting at 11 o'clock for a few hours after that, and then potentially rolling into the Colin McEnroe show about toothbrushes at 1 o'clock, which I think should provide an interesting transition. I want to quickly get to a phone call from Mike in West Hartford. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What's on your mind?
In New York, Bill de Blasio partners with NPR Radio, and basically he creates what he calls the Ask the Mayor sort of discussion for local residents to pose questions directly to him. And I feel like Ned Lamont, if he were able to partner with you guys to do something similar, that would create a platform for residents in Connecticut to basically ask key questions that are of concern to them directly to this new governor. Because as you and I know, you know, Connecticut is facing a lot of unique challenges. And I feel like residents have a lot of things that they would like to see addressed. And I feel like that would be a great way, not only for Ned Lamont to hear directly from residents, but also for it to be done on a platform like NPR. I know a lot of people listen
Well, Mike, first of all, thank you very much for thinking highly of our platform and for suggesting that. And I know what you're talking about with Bill de Blasio. I think, Colin, when Dan Malloy started, and of course, we had historically come out of a governorship where Jody Rell did not want to talk to the media at all, including not coming on here and answering questions from listeners ever on our program Where We Live. Dan Malloy did it with me about once a month for a very long time. He got upset with me for a while, and then he didn't. Then he came back and did it again for a while. I don't know. This is probably a not bad idea for Ned Lamont to do.
Yes, fine. I want to say this, and I think I'll get a concurrence from Daniela. I don't know about this guy over here. But I would like to say don't rush Ned Lamont too fast on this, all right? He's a new governor. I mean, Malloy came in thinking he knew all the answers, and maybe it was kind of legitimate to put him on the spot. Ned Lamont's got to get a budget out. That's the first thing he's got to do, right? He's got to pull a budget together. I don't know, you know, how much sort of amateur input he can handle during that period. He's got to assemble a staff. He's got to have effectively a cabinet. Meanwhile, at the legislative level, there's going to be also quite a lot of uncertainty. I think Marty Looney's caucus, the Democratic caucus in the Senate, has 40% new members. It's something like that. Almost half the caucus is new people.
You mean Matt Lesser's new caucus?
Matt Lesser's new caucus, yes. So so they've got to figure out sort of who's up there and what their priorities are and everything. So I think it's great to get citizen input, but I sort of feel like maybe just let's get through this budget process, let Lamont get his sea legs a little bit, try to figure out what he's doing. Maybe that sounds like I'm babying him or something. I just sort of feel like it's going to take a little while before he can incorporate everybody else's thing.
It is an interesting point, though, Daniela, this idea of walking into a job that's this complex and knowing what to do right away and having all the answers. It's a hard job. There's a lot to understand, and you're assembling a staff. You're assembling an identity in the office while you're trying to run the state.
Yeah, and I think Governor-elect Lamont has tried to cast a wide net. I mean, look at this transition committee that he's put together with lots of people from various walks of life, various areas of expertise. And then, you know, he had that big open house at Eastern Connecticut, you know, where hundreds of people showed up. I mean, he appears to be wanting to hear lots of different viewpoints and opinion,
including maybe from people like Mike, who calls in.
He's just spent 11 months on the campaign trail. That's when you check in with voters. He's got 11 months of notes about what people said. He didn't knock on a lot of doors, but he sort of virtually knocked on doors. And I think he's got plenty of ideas about what people think in this world.
Okay, I know you've got plenty of ideas about this next topic, Danny, about whether or not this state and the entire country might be facing recession. There's all sorts of interesting markers out there. One that we'll talk about is the big layoffs at GM, but other major manufacturers, other companies that are a big part of the U.S. economy have been announcing layoffs recently. We saw the Dow drop, you know, 800 points yesterday. And if you want a little primer on this, take a listen to last night's Marketplace, where Kai Rizdal and his team put together a pretty interesting series of factoids that seem to point to various economic indicators looking like a recession. Christine Stewart in CT News Junkie quotes Neil Ayers, the Office of Fiscal Analysis here in Connecticut, saying if we make it through this current year without a recession, it matches the all-time record. If we make it through the biennium, it would exceed the all-time record by 20%. A lot of things pointing toward maybe it's time for a recession again.
While we were listening to talking about listening to people, I made a list of 7 recession signs, and I'm going to go through them in 35 seconds, 5 seconds
each. Is this like a Burma shave sort of situation?
Yeah, this is signs of recession.
The Book of Revelations.
One is rising public debt. The second is timing. We're coming up on the longest boom cycle ever, and that's just simple inevitability. The third is technical, the inverted yield curve. We are close to the one-year bond or one-year debt being higher interest rate than the 10-year bond, right? And that's a sign of inflation because it means people have lower confidence in long-term economic strength. That is the 10-year. Unsustainable unemployment. We're at under what's called the natural rate of unemployment. The only way to get back to it is by doing things that overshoot the mark and get you back into recession. Trade crisis by Trump, that speaks for itself. The market volatility is in and of itself a sign of instability in the economy, aside from the fact that it's generally down for the year, which of course it is. Finally, the technology cycle. We're at the point in the technology cycle where it's not creating great new – you know, if you look at Apple and if you look at Google, they're not creating great new wealth at this point. They're feeding off of prior innovation. And that's all a sign of – and the good news for Connecticut
are
is –
Are locusts
we,
in there?
Yes.
Do we have locusts?
We have locusts, yes. Okay. The good news for Connecticut is we are in a better position than we have been before to sustain a recession.
A better position. Give me one reason why.
Defense industry, insurance industry are both in strong balance sheet position to not have to make deep cuts during a recession. And they're generally recession proof, especially with a Republican hawk as president.
I'll take the point on the defense industry, given the instability of the world and given the right. fact that we've got a Republican president. The insurance industry, I don't know, short-term, long-term, what are the prospects for an industry that, I don't know, is so tied up in some of the major calamities that we see coming forward? I mean, we're staring down the barrel of a climate change crisis, and I guess I just wonder if the insurance industry is going to be able to, let's just say, weather that storm.
Not particularly well, but not particularly badly. As the manufacturing sector, you may see the gains that we've seen in the manufacturing sector might decline more precipitously than what we've seen in insurance. So I'm not saying, look, no, a recession, no one does well in a recession. I'm not saying we are. But if you look at Connecticut's housing market, for example, we never had great gains. So we're not going to fall quite as far as the states that did.
Colin, quick thought?
Help me. Help me. No, I don't know. I read that OFA report, which is like the pie charts of doom. You know, it didn't look too good. I'm going to kind of defer. I mean, Danny really studies this stuff a lot more than I do. And I believe what he said, which is probably a huge mistake.
Don't
well,
believe it.
I don't know that it's a huge mistake.
I'm not making any bets based on what Danny says, but what you said just made a certain amount of sense.
Let's loop back, though, to your earlier point, Daniela, which is that this governor, this government – is banking on some version of economic growth to engineer the way out of the crisis that we're in. If we are headed in the opposite direction, what does that mean? And how are people at the state capitol preparing for this? I mean, do you hear talk about how will we weather the next recession as we've gotten out more slowly than the rest of the country of the last recession?
No, I'm not hearing a lot of talk about that. We're hearing a lot of talk about, you know, as Danny mentioned, you know, big new initiatives that some of which might, you know, cost a lot of money. But I think, you know, what the governor said on the campaign trail over and over again is, you know, he has confidence in his sort of ability and his connections in the business world to help the state economy grow. And, you know, we'll see.
Should we take as one of the markers, one of the 7 or 8 or 10 doom signs that you pointed to earlier, Dan, the breakup of United Technologies into various component parts, something that's happened over the course of the last week and maybe has some people in the state, especially those of you who look very closely at the business sector and manufacturing sector? I mean, should we be worried?
I think the breakup is not a sign of a worry. The breakup is a sign of pressure from Wall Street on this, you know, giant conglomerate that says we want you to be a simpler company, just like we saw pressure on GE and pressure on the big financial firms to not get quite as big, although that didn't bear out.
I was going to say it's less the pressure on GE. It's just this crushing weight on GE.
Well, that's right. Yeah, but it works in both directions. I think that the breakup of United Technologies is somewhat healthy. I think you have to worry if you're an airplane maker like Boeing or Airbus and all of a sudden all your suppliers are rolled up into one company. Everything that goes into the plane is one. But as far as the macro economy, I don't see it as a sign one way or the other. I think it's a big deal for Connecticut.
Is it a big deal for Connecticut, Colin?
Well, I hope it's a – first of all, this goes back to the Bridgewater thing in corporate welfare. What do we give UTC, $400 million in tax breaks?
Tax breaks that they had already earned and couldn't use.
Yeah. So we unlocked $400 million in tax breaks. I assume that there's some gratitude for that was worth doing. You know, if in fact the times get a little bit more stressful, we'll see how much loyalty we get out of this. Just to go back to the Doomsday Commission. In the original Doomsday Commission report, they used the term exemptions. And I take exemptions the way they use it to mean entities that could be paying taxes that for one reason or other are not paying taxes. And they cited an OFA report, I think, that said that if we got rid of all exemptions that anybody is getting in Connecticut, it would be worth $5.1 $1 billion. So we can solve a lot of problems if we could get rid of exemptions, but a lot of them are lobbied for and locked into by various kinds of commitments. I would expect UTC to honor all of its commitments, given some of the largesse directed its way.
As we were talking about the importance of the business community here in the state, I want to turn to Danielle Altomare, who wrote a very nice profile of Annie Lamont, Connecticut's next first partner. Annie Lamont, a very different sort of first lady for the state, including the fact that she has her own business. She's a venture capitalist. She's somebody who knows an awful lot of people who are spending money and hiring people here in our state.
She is an incredibly successful venture capitalist. It's a world that is dominated by men. She's been in it for many years and is extremely successful and is a huge asset, I think, to the governor-elect.
Hey, tell me how she's an asset. I mean, how exactly do you think that relationship is going to work? Somebody who is so successful, and I assume will continue to be successful at her job while her husband tries to fix the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's going to continue to work and remain downstate in Fairfield County while he's up here in Hartford, you know, running Connecticut. But, you know, she has such deep roots and such deep connections into this world. And her area of expertise, healthcare finance and those working with those types of firms is sort of exactly where a lot of the most exciting things are happening in the state. When you look at things that are going on in Hartford, that's kind of becoming our niche.
How exactly has the first couple so far talked about navigating the potential issue with someone who gets money to new startup companies that maybe are going to do big things in the state, and now the husband has another big checkbook from the state to give people startup money and help to bring in jobs?
Sure, and there are potential ethical issues. I asked her about that, and she said, well, you know, we're going to be real transparent, real open, but, you know, it may come down to more than that. I mean, it could be potentially be tricky for them.
It could be.
The nature of venture capital like Oak that she's the partner of, managing partner,
yeah,
I think,
yeah,
is they're not dealing with a great large number of companies that are doing business with Connecticut. They're not dealing with a great large number of companies at all. There's just really a relatively few in the stable, and they manage them, help manage them. And they're really not typically companies that are directly doing business with the state. It's not like, a public works type of thing. I wouldn't think there's too much of a worry. The worry is, can we get her on board on the CI? If Kathy Malloy can be the Greater Hartford Arts Council, she can go to work at CI, I think, Connecticut Innovation. So. Better take a pay cut of a couple $1 million.
Right. I don't think that they're going to do that. First of all, I would agree. I don't see this conflict of interest or anything like that as a major concern here. This is not the Trump organization where, you know, you're still trying to make money from your job in the White House. But and I actually do think, first of all, I love Daniela's story. I thought it was terrific. If people haven't read it, they should read it. I mean, there's a lot about her business acumen. There's the kinds of stories that they should probably never tell in it, including this adorable story about they're recently out of college, I think, and they're traveling in France with Chase Rogers, and they bought this little car, and then the engine blows up, and Nanny takes over and says, we're going to sell the car at the gas station and take the ferry to where. You know, we've all had that happen, right? We're in France, and the car we bought blows the engine, and what are we going to do? Who hasn't been there?
Hashtag relatable.
Right.
Yes.
Totally relatable. But I don't know. I've met her once. She doesn't know as much about the Packers as she says she does. She's from Wisconsin originally, and I guess her brothers are Packers fans. But I tried to get her going on the whole question of, you know, the running back is the third pass option.
I know you did, though, maybe go down memory lane a little bit and think, Colin, about past first spouses and how she might fit in this continuum.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to do my whole bitchy litany that I did in the email to you guys, but I will say that I thought about all the previous first spouses going all the way back to Tom Grasso. That's how far I go back with governors. I actually think that Nikki O'Neill was maybe the best first lady ever. You know, I mean, she was like very, very down to earth. She's a former public school teacher. She actually got out and listened to people, talked to people, brought the ideas back to her husband that were important ideas. She was kind of like, you know, getting some street information in a way that you typically don't see. I mean, the other person who really threw her heart and soul into it was Patty Rowland. I mean, she was like really into being first lady. Unfortunately, like everything else having to do with the Rowlands, that particular thing jumped the rail. rails. And, of course, famously, she did right around this time of year.
Yes, this time of year,
did this, she did this Christmas poem, this Christmas poem, which she read publicly, which was, among other things, an attack on the press that was investigating them at the time. And it had something about John Linder going through their garbage cans or something. So,
were you at that press conference? Were you at that speech?
I was not.
Yeah. Were you at that speech?
No, it was the Middlesex Chamber, right?
I was there, and I just remember looking around at the assembled press thinking, my goodness, here she goes. This is exactly what she's doing right now. It was quite a moment.
Right. No. I wasn't there because John Linder had knocked over my garbage cans the night before, and I was like, I had to spend the whole morning cleaning it up.
You know, I want to get back to something you said. I think that two of the Lamont children do have a new line of perfume called Capital Essence. So be careful about not comparing them to Trump.
Very, very quickly, Republicans that say Senate took a big hit in last month's election, losing 5 of 18 seats they previously held. Now some other bad news. An admission by the Senate Republicans' top lawyer, Michael Cronin, that he misappropriated tens of thousands of dollars from an account meant for election-related expenses. I don't know, a misappropriation, Danny? It sounds like maybe stealing is the word.
That's what Kevin Kane is calling it, I don't think.
One possible scenario that may come out is that he was in charge of this money solely. And the money wasn't immediately needed, and he may have tried to borrow it with the intention of paying it back just to make ends meet for a short time. We could see something like that come out, and it's obviously unfortunate. It would still be a crime as well as being a campaign violation, but that's sort of an indication of what happens when one person controls a whole bunch of public money.
Yeah, I would just like to say as a point of law, I was going to pay it back. Has never worked ever in any embezzling case ever in the history of
Eddie Perez said, I did pay it back.
Right.
But there's been a series of these sort of things over the last couple of years, Daniela, with the state GOP, sort of wondering whether or not they can get their house in order. We've talked on the show previously about how they run candidates to regain some control that they lost. But when you have things like this, it doesn't help.
No, definitely doesn't help. It hurts.
It hurts quite a bit. Hey, when we come back.
Can I just bring out one mildly interesting thing about this?
Absolutely, sure.
So most of these kinds of cases are federal prosecutions.
Yes.
This looks like it's going to be a state prosecution. It went to Kevin Kane. And I think the reason for that was they weren't up on this. In other words, the feds weren't in the process of investigating this guy or how the Senate Republicans act or anything. Fasano, I think, kind of found out about
this. You really have to give him credit. Yeah. He did a lot of investigating on this.
So typically the feds investigate this. Chris Matty was the one who investigated. George Gallo is a similar kind of case. I'll just be interested to see what Kevin Kane's operation does with this. And if it goes all the way, how a state judge will deal with sentencing too. Like, is it going to be a year plus a day, which seems to be like the standard operating federal sentence for corruption in Connecticut, or is it going to be more?
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to hear from our panelists about some of their feats of strength over the course of this last week, or maybe the airing of some grievances. We're talking with Colin McEnroe, Danielle Altomare, and Dan Haar here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking with Danny Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media, Daniela Altomare from The Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe, as we like to end the program with some feats of strength or airing of grievances, some kudos and gripes. I'll go first to you, Daniela. Have anything really exciting that you want to talk about or something you want to grumble about this week?
I guess I will talk about one of my new obsessions, which is the New York Times Watching newsletter. It's about, I don't know if you guys subscribe to it. They have all kinds of newsletters, some on politics, some on all various topics. And the Watching newsletter is on TV shows.
Ah.
And through this newsletter, I discovered a new TV obsession. About a month ago, they mentioned this show that's new on Amazon Prime. It's called Being Erica. And it was broadcast on Canadian television back in like 2009, 2010. Now it's on Amazon Prime. It's a great show, very sweet, sort of a coming of age story about a young woman growing up in Toronto and navigating the world. And it's charming and it's funny and it's sad and it's about regret and just, life. It's really beautiful.
I've never heard of this. And I also don't subscribe to this. So again, Watching is the newsletter from the New York Times
that
helped to tip you off on Canadian TV.
Yeah. It comes out every couple of days. They have really smart culture writers telling you what you should watch on TV. So.
Very cool.
That's a very good feat of strength.
I like that. That's a very good feat. How about you, Danny?
If I say something nice, am I still going to have time to go negative?
Yeah, you get going. Here we go.
Good. I want to just go broad here and say that lost in the general sort of cultural malaise that we're living as far as public life is that we're really living in a food paradise era right now.
Yes.
Because of global trade in you know various types of food, and because of more and more sort of general awareness of things like grinding your own spices. You know, I sort of invented a way to grind up some stuff. And and
all right.
And when you go even to just like the regular supermarket, if you compare that to what it was when we were kids, right, or if we're old enough, you know, when a long time ago when we were kids, this is the options out there in both restaurants. There are some low cost. I don't have to name them, but you know, even an expensive West Hartford Center where I live,
it's better to find more good food.
That's right.
It's
there easier. Are some really, really good, very, very low cost options out there that are extraordinarily well made. And I think we forget the fact that we're living in an era of a food paradise, if that's what we want. And I do.
Okay, you have a very quick time to say something negative.
Yeah, public noise. What's the deal, especially in the fall, with people blowing? Like, why is it not acceptable for things to smell and for things to do all kinds of other things that are not acceptable, but noise everywhere you go? You put your card in the gas station and it starts to make noise at you. What's the deal with that?
What's the deal with that? We didn't think to call this segment "What's the Deal with That" with Danny Hart.
But he did sound like some member of the Costanza family as he was doing that. It was very authentic sounding.
Airing of grievances.
What's the deal with public noise?
So I'm going to build a little bit on what Danny said. I want to talk just quickly about coffee. So there's this whole theory that coffee was one of the triggers of the Enlightenment, that when people started gathering in coffee shops and drinking something that didn't make them forget what they said the next day and made them think fast and be somewhat coherent, that actually helped usher in the age of reason. And I think coffee still kind of does that. If you have a lot of coffee shops, people are running into one another, talking to one another, exchanging information. I mean, how do we hash out our differences? Where do we get some of our new ideas? It's good to have good coffee shops. Now, New Haven, for a long time, really sort of had the lead in this. I mean, Willoughby's is a great coffee shop, Coffee with a K. They've got a whole bunch of them. I feel as though, first of all, Hartford is catching up. I think Story and Soil, which is right near the Capitol and right near the Hartford Current, it's a terrific coffee shop. It's probably, just for the coffee, better than any of the New Haven coffee shops. Mm. We should do a shout out to Blue State because they're everywhere. They're Hartford, they're New Haven. But so I think coffee is like a really good thing, and it's very healthy to have coffee shops where people can comfortably gather and exchange ideas. I want to go on a tour. I want to learn more about them. So there's a place called, I think, Bean at 226 in Windsor. Do you know that one?
I'm a tea guy.
I'm just wondering. I'm wondering where you meet people. So anyway.
In the supermarket.
That'll be my next.
In the spice aisle.
So anyway, we're all kind of catching up with coffee. Yeah. Sarah's downtown in Hartford is also really terrific. We're all catching up with New Haven and having a coffee culture.
So I'm going to end with a little bit of a feat of strength as well. And it could be seen as a negative. The coverage throughout the course of this last week since the death of George H.W. Bush has been interesting, because in my social media feed, it's almost equally split between people who knew the man personally, or who worked with him, or who admired him, saying glowing things about him, and other people saying really terrible things about him, mostly based on some of the policies that did negatively impact their lives. The thing that I will say that's been great about this last week, and we got a couple minutes maybe to remember George H.W. Bush here, Colin, is that it's allowed us to consider history and to actually think back about complex people over time. And when a U.S. president dies, there's a lot of baggage that goes along with it. But the idea that we can travel back in time to think about what he had growing up, who he became, what roles he served in public life, and what his presidency was like for good and bad, I think that that's something that we don't do often enough in this news cycle, to step back and look at the arc of history.
Right. I had a chance to interview on stage last year or 2 years ago, maybe, John Meacham, who's Bush's biographer and one of the great George H.W. Bush fans of all time. It was a biographer really kind of falling in love with this subject. I guess one of the things that I would quickly remind people with a Connecticut connection, and Frankie Graziano reported on this weekend, you know, Barbara Hackman Franklin, a woman Secretary of Commerce. She's, you know, at least connected to, I think still owns a home in Bristol. There's sort of a nice Connecticut story there about him making a very special effort. I don't know that there had ever been a woman Secretary of Commerce before. Don't hold me to that. That might not be the case. But one of his many, you know, things that he did.
Any thoughts, Daniela, on the way in which George H.W. Bush has been remembered throughout the course of this last week?
It's been really interesting because you see on social media a real divide. I mean, there was a great story yesterday in the New York Times about, you know, Bush's attitude and policies toward people with AIDS. And there was a real backlash. And then also, you know, let's not forget a year ago, you know, Collins pointing out appointing a woman to Secretary of Commerce. But he was also there were also a series of women, very credible allegations of, you know, things he did both in recent years and going back a ways that, you know, today in the Me Too movement, were really troubling.
A really interesting one.
A complicated man.
Yeah, very complicated man. One of the interesting ones that came up, WBUR had reported on this this week. He really did a good job helping to use federal dollars to clean up Boston Harbor. He did it in part to sort of rub Michael Dukakis' face in it. Last 10 seconds, Danny.
The good and bad about George H.W. Bush is a reminder that if you live a decent life, that's how you're going to be remembered, not for what policies you advanced or didn't advance.
Danny Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media, Danielle Altamari from the Hartford Current, Colin McEnroe from Connecticut Public Radio. Thanks to everyone who produces this the show, including pros Scott Breedy, Katie Tolarski, Kion Wolf, Betsy Kaplan. Thanks for your help here in the Wheelhouse.